אתם עם SBS בעברית.
אדיר, welcome to SBS Hebrew.
My pleasure to be here.
Can you please give us a little bio on who you are? I know that you're one half of the Contrarians podcast with Adam Schwab, but please tell us about yourself and him and how you got the podcast started.
Well, I'm happy you got more specific with that question, because when you asked me for a bio on who I am, I thought it's a deep psychological question that I'm not sure I'm qualified to answer. So I'll tell you about the podcast.
Take a lie detector test.
No, I would pass a lie detector test, because I would mostly just be lying to myself. And so I think that that's all right. You can do those tests if you lie to yourself. It's an easy question. The podcast got started. So I had a podcast, and he interviewed me on his podcast, and it was really fun and enjoyable. And we knew each other, but we weren't close friends or anything like that. But we both really enjoyed it. And then for the next 6 months, people would periodically come up to me and just say, I listened to this podcast that Adam did, and you guys like had some kind of chemistry. You should do a podcast together. And so people kept coming up and saying this. You know, probably a dozen people said it to me over 6 months. And I said to Adam, if you ever want to do a podcast with me, I'm definitely up for it. I'm just not prepared to do any work. So if somehow we can do a podcast, I just turn up and speak, and everything else is handled by other people, probably you. It turned out that we actually got a couple of producers to come in and handle it. But he does a lot of it, that I'm open to it. And I would say 3 months, we had those conversations for 3 months, and eventually he said, let's do it. And we gave it a go, and the crazy thing about it was I felt like we were just doing it for ourselves, because it would be fun. And I said to him, you know, 20 people are going to listen to this, and then after three episodes it'll be down to 10 people, and we'll be related to most of them. And it, you know, surprisingly, it actually successful. But that was not my expectation when we started off doing it.
Oh, well done you. I know, Adir, about you that you used to study medicine.
Yes, I did a medical degree. I worked as a doctor a bit. Yeah.
So you're a qualified practitioner as well.
I'm qualified and I'm still registered. However, I will emphasize that if something happens and it's down to me, then it's better than nothing, but you should try and hunt down a practicing doctor first, because I have not practiced for quite a while.
Good to know. Are there any transferable skills from medicine that you take into the business world?
That's a good question. You know, I feel like it's possible to answer this question so that it sounds sophisticated, and it would probably mostly be just these fabrications of how it would apply to the business world. And I think a more honest answer is almost the only bit of it that applies to the business world. Well, maybe I'll say these two things that apply. One is, at some point in medicine, you realize that there is no way to get through it without doing an insane amount of work, predominantly memorizing. And so it really developed my memory. And so now when I read things, it's very easy for me to remember things. And often I'll sit in the podcast and we'll be talking about a business, and I'll reel off some numbers, and people will be a bit surprised that I don't have those numbers in front of me. And I think that that is largely due to having gone through medical school and having to memorize large amounts of information. The other thing I think that is relevant is maybe broader than just business, which is that medicine, for better or worse, it deals with life and death stuff. And it's very, there's nothing that really happens in medicine. In my experience, I was mostly a junior doctor. There's nothing that happens that's not very consequential. And so then when you go into business and people are panicky about stuff, or there's some disaster, it's very easy to keep it in perspective and say, you know, no one is likely to die as a consequence of anything that we're talking about right now. And so it's not that important. And so relax, like, we'll work it out. It's not life and death. I think that's the real advantage of that. And when I talk to my friends who, you know, have been, let's say, soldiers that have seen combat, they walk away with the same perspective on life. I just got it in a much less, in a way that doesn't leave PTSD, frankly. I got it in a much easier way, yeah. But it's the same perspective on, you know, knowing what's really important in life and what's less important.
Just extending that, what you just said there about the soldiers, do you think that there's something that ignites a pro-risk kind of mentality for people that have been in war zones, or that have seen death up close in any capacity?
Yeah, I think, well, I think, you know, there's kind of a difference. I mean, when I said there's overlap with me and, you know, people who have been in combat, like there's the Venn diagram has a little bit of overlap and then it doesn't overlap for the rest of it. And I think, you know, for people in my experience, for people that have been in combat, like they definitely perceive the idea of being at risk or being under fire in, it is much more dramatic than having been in an emergency room. But the little bits of overlap that are there certainly are understanding that, like risk is all about ideally having like a memory and an experience and processes for how to operate under in times of extreme pressure and high intensity. Because mm-hmm. if you look in an emergency room, to the layperson, it looks a bit out of control, especially let's say someone is brought in. I worked in Dandenong Hospital in Melbourne and I did a rotation there. There were lots of drug overdoses. People would be brought in and like they might not be breathing. They had an overdose. Literally their friend, I use that term quite liberally in this context, would pull up out of the front of the hospital and throw them out of the car and then drive away. And so it looks like it's mayhem when that person is brought in, but to the doctor inside the emergency department, there is just a system and a process for working systematically through that problem and trying to come out with a positive outcome at the other side. And the best is when you don't really have to think about it in the heat of the moment. You just go into an automatic kind of routine based on experience. And I think the same is true with my experiences with my friends who have been in combat, that there is training and ideally you're just executing that training when you're under fire. And so I think it's less about a preparedness to take risk and more about understanding that everything is risky and the best ways to deal with risk is if you've been trained to manage under fire or under high pressure moments.
So that's a skill set that you think you can improve on, having that level equanimity and just being very methodical.
Because everything feels all of these moments when you're under extreme pressure, they all feel very different from one another, and like the detail of it is different, but fundamentally the things that are similar is that it's hard to make calm, sensible decisions in the moment if you haven't thought through this in advance and thought about how to deal with these situations in advance. And so I definitely think training, experience, simulations, whatever it is that you've managed to go through beforehand dramatically improves the decision-making process. And the more comfortable you can be with making decisions in high-pressure moments, the more able you are to take increasingly greater calculated risks is how I would think about that.
So conversely, the A-grade university student that does theoretically very well at school and then carries on well at university and then tries to start a startup, are they better positioned to have a successful startup?
Well, I think there's this quote from Mike Tyson, you know, the boxer. I'm not really a fan of these like kind of blood sports, but there is a quote which I'm going to not do justice to, but he said something like everyone has a strategy until they get punched in the face. And that is a great bit of advice for startup life, which is, you know, like essentially startups, like leading a startup or being senior in a startup is just about getting punched in the face many times every single day and then finding yourself probably in the gutter and then having to get up the next morning and do it again. And the people that are best at startups, they somehow they find that fun. I always found that fun. Like that high pressure and you're constantly under attack, like there is something about that is just, I don't know, an enjoyable way to live for some, like, you know, strangely adjusted segment of the population. And I do think that, like, learning finance is a very, very important skill for leading a startup. And almost nobody has that background. I didn't have that background. I had to learn it on the job and then read books about it. And so I think that there is a very strong place for some academic basis to leading a startup. But 80 or 90% of running a startup is just about developing this emotion where you feel comfortable and maybe even look forward to like getting punched every day and trying to figure out how to dodge it and maybe punch back a little bit. And, you know, obviously don't mean that in a literal sense, but I think
Adir thinks that everyone should be a masochist, just like him.
Well, the crazy thing about it is that after a while, you learn that, like, there are ways to get punched less often, and there are ways that you can actually you navigate your way through this for good things to happen. But I definitely think that without the day-to-day experience of being in that high-pressure situation where lots of things are going against you every day, especially in the early stages, like, I think that ultimately is what sets people up to be really strong in startups. And if you said to me a bit of a different way, like, how would I think about bringing people into organizations that I'm a part of, the academic, apart from very specific examples like a CFO, for example, the academic background is not very important to me. I care much more about what they've done in the past and what their general sentiment is towards giving it their all and resilience under pressure.
Definitely. So those characteristics would be something like resilience. What else would you say?
I would say,
do you look the way they would answer a question?
Well, I think it's very hard to interview people in a traditional sense, or at least I'll say I found it very hard to interview people in a traditional sense. It's much more normal for me to sit down and have just a very open, direct conversation with someone and just talk about things they've done and why they did things in a particular way. And what happens in business when people are early on in their careers is they make a huge number of mistakes, especially first-time founders of startups. I can talk from personal experience. And so effectively what's happened is that all of those mistakes and messing things up, that's a form of tuition, where if you've raised money, somebody else has paid for that tuition. And I'm much less concerned about things that have gone wrong and much more interested to know why they went wrong and what people have learnt from them. And so that to me is the basis for a conversation when I'm thinking about bringing people into an organization. And also, I know it's very unpopular to say this, but also how hard they're prepared to work. You know, there have been laws that have been passed now that are a right to disconnect laws, which effectively means when you're not in work hours, your boss does not have a right to contact you. And in most roles, I'm quite supportive of that conceptually. But if you're going to be involved in a startup in a senior role, like, you have to feel like this is a fundamental part of your sense of self-worth. It's terrible psychologically to say what I've just said, but that is a huge determinant on how successful the startup actually is, in my experience.
Now, Adir, there are multifarious business podcasts out there. How does the Contrarians podcast differ or compared to the All In podcast? I mean, obviously you've got different audiences listening to both, but what do people get from your podcast versus the All In podcast?
It's amazing that you've raised the All In podcast. I have to admit, I had not listened to the All In podcast, I had been on Jason Calacanis' own podcast like years ago for Catapult. And so I then listened to All In. And I see why so many people compare us. I think, apart from the fact that the focus that we have is very heavily on Australian content, I think that's been one of the core differences. Maybe what I would say is in the All In podcast, it seems like the four guys are all trying to be the smartest person in the room and are all trying to demonstrate like how smart they are. Very smart. And I think the difference in when I speak to Adam is each of us is happy to be proven wrong by the other and very willing to concede that we've been wrong about this point and the other person is right. And I think that's one of the key differences, frankly.
So how much time do you actually put aside, because you've both got day jobs and, I mean, they obviously take up the bulk of your time, but how much time do you actually allocate to the podcast?
I think the podcast maybe has 20 minutes of edited content that you don't hear. And right. So the sum total of my involvement is however long the podcast is plus 20 minutes a week. That's my involvement. Mm-hmm. Literally, I just turn up and speak and then go on with life. And as I said, there are a couple of producers, Mike and Keelan, that are kind of there and then do all of the work afterwards. And I think Adam puts a little bit more time into thinking about what topics he might want to discuss. In general, I don't look at the topics until I turn up. So that's my involvement.
Adir, I want to ask you about small businesses in Australia. And I'd like to know from your opinion, what state is the most conducive to starting a small business? Let me extend the question to, is it even worth starting a small business here in Australia, or would you just go straight to somewhere like America or Europe And what are the differences in raising capital in Australia versus America?
When you mention small business, I'll tighten it up in my answer and I'll talk about businesses that are growth businesses, let's call them. They may be tech, they may not be tech, but they're businesses that are trying to grow, which is not a virtue, by the way, in my view. Like, there are many people that open businesses that are small businesses within a community and they want to get them to a certain size, have a nice lifestyle, contribute to the community. I certainly think there's at least as much virtue in that in as in high growth businesses, but my experience is predominantly in high growth businesses. If I was 22 today and had not been to university, or maybe had finished a three-year degree and wanted to do a startup and had no and nothing binding me to Australia, I think I would get on a plane and go to somewhere like New York or somewhere, or maybe I'd do Tel Aviv, depending on my background. And I think it would be a more fun place to do a startup. I would be exposed to more interesting people. You know, maybe I'd go to the Valley, like Silicon Valley. Maybe I'd go to Austin in Texas. Well, I would probably just try to go somewhere that would put me out of my comfort zone and where I'd be surrounded with other like-minded people. And I think it would just be a much more fun experience. And so if you've got the ability to do that, personally, I would do that. But most people are not going to do that. Most people are going to stay in Australia and do what Aussies are going to do whatever they're doing in Australia. And so then it comes down to, you know, where in Australia should you do it? And the thing is this, venture capital tends to be focused in Sydney and Melbourne in Australia, and with some in Queensland. I know that everybody else will get upset and they'll say, well, it is in Adelaide and Perth, and it's true, it is, but that's where it tends to be focused. And so the question is, like, you know, do you have to be around these VCs to have a high growth business? And mostly the answer is no, because very few businesses are funded by venture capital. But the ones that are, it's probably easier to be in those major cities and major places. But I'm not sure that is the key determinant. The key determinant is, where can I get talent? And what if I have a remote business? And so I don't think it really matters. And I know lots of people I am friends with would love me to say Victoria is a terrible place to do business at the moment. And I think that's true if you're running an existing business employing people in Victoria. But in general, I've seen lots of businesses out of the Gold Coast and out of Brisbane that are taking off. Sydney and Melbourne have always had lots. It's a long-winded way of saying I don't think it matters. You can build a really high-quality business almost anywhere in Australia. You can build it regionally in Australia if you can get access to talent. And if it's venture capital worthy, venture capitalists will find a way to find you and give you money and definitely introduce yourself, but I don't think that's going to be an impediment. I think Australia is still a very good country to build a high-growth business in.
Well, that's a good segue into this next question that I have for you, because we're a country of over 26 million people. We have over 83,000 startups and we have just 13 unicorns. So for comparison, if we look to the entire population of the Nordics, where cumulatively they have the same population of Australia, but they have a total of 78 unicorn startups, how's that for comparison? Where are we falling over?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the Nordics. You know, everyone usually talks about Israel because Israel has got the largest per capita number of unicorns after, well, that's Tel Aviv and the surrounding area.
Then Israel.
Well, Israel is a unique example. That's why. I mean, maybe they're all unique. So, like, Israel, I think you can't replicate the idea that there is a certain level of not even risk tolerance, but the pursuit, understanding the risk return curve and being prepared to move down the risk return curve, and the Israeli cultural attitude towards failure and being a form of tuition is completely different to most other countries. And maybe Silicon Valley has a similar attitude to that. The Nordics, I think, are more interesting. I was recently in Copenhagen. Copenhagen does not feel anything like Tel Aviv. It feels nothing like Silicon Valley. It feels like it's not an especially risk-tolerant type of environment. It has some of the same problems for risk tolerance as Australia has, which is it is possible in Australia to have a job inside a corporation and to earn $200,000 a year, certainly $150,000 a year, without taking any perceived risk. I would argue it is risky to have those jobs because you can be fired, right? But and so the Nordics is a tough question, right? Like, how do you get these, you know, preponderance of companies out of the Nordics? And I think that there is something about being European focused and the ability to build these companies in Europe and to grow them in Europe before going more global, that seems to have some kind of advantage. But if you read books about Spotify, and you will see a founder that hated the fact that he came from this country that seemed to have such a low risk tolerance. And so I'm not sure that I can comprehensively answer that for Northern Europe in the same way that I feel, you know, I can answer it for a country like Israel, frankly. And I think Australia definitely has a lower risk tolerance. Definitely smart people in Australia, they don't often go into tech, in my experience. Some do, but so many people just gravitate towards finance or towards law, used to be towards medicine. I think that's diminished. And so I think there's also a different attitude to where being in tech sits on the social hierarchy, because in Israel it sits at the top of the social hierarchy and it doesn't sit there in a country like Australia.
And just going back to the Nordics for a second, I mean, another very interesting point is the fact that it's such a strongly socialist bloc. Mm. I mean, each country is very socialist. So you're never going to be out of money or out of work per se, because there's such a strong safety net there. Yet there is still such defiant determination to have so many startups. So it flies in the face of actually having such a strong startup scene, which is interesting.
They're very patriotic. In the Nordics, like, it's a very patriotic place. In, like, because, you know, I was in only in Copenhagen, know, a week or two, but like I go out and like I love people, so I try to talk to everybody. Their English is perfect there, so you can have these conversations with them. You know, maybe they're not forthcoming for the first 20 minutes of the conversation, but like you can warm them up and they get into it. I really like the Danes, I have to say, and I mean it's a great city, and they're a culture that I really warm to. I think that that they are very patriotic. There definitely does you know, the attitude in Denmark, the national kind of line that guides the country, is something along the lines of everybody has enough, but nobody has too much, or something along those lines. I haven't quoted it perfectly, but it is not just about people having enough to survive. It is also about, at the top end, people not running away and being too rich and too flamboyant. It is like this view that there is a range that people should live within, and that is how you have a good cohesive society. And so you're right, like it is not the same as the US, where there's just this desire to make tons of money, and that is what drives a lot of the startup culture. Like that is not the Nordic or the Danish, let's say, attitude. I think that there's an element of patriotism and doing something good in the country. There's a ton of money available to fund things, like they are rich countries. But beyond that, I would be as interested as you would be to understand exactly what the nuances are. And I suspect that there is a difference between, say, Sweden and Denmark. I don't think that they have the same cultural drivers. They're not the same cultures, those two countries.
Now, I just want to turn to business, because business and politics are two sides of the same coin. So mm-hmm. Let's just shift our gaze to business for a moment. Trump's corporatizing the political landscape in America. They're dropping government departments from, I think, just under 500 to under 100. They're making government smaller and more efficient with more accountability. Could that have a flow-on effect, or at the very least serve as a template for Australian politics and the business sector?
Theoretically, it's hard to disagree with the notion of we would like to deliver the same benefits for much less money. I suspect it's easier said than done, and they'll have some success at doing it, but 500 to 100 and, like, you know, an 80% cut in expenditure or waste or whatever, you know, this is good to have aspirations. I'm not sure they'll ever get there, but it's a positive idea. We can talk about Australia, but we can talk also about Western democracy more broadly. One of the beauties of Western democracy is that it has this idea of social justice, I guess, that pervades these countries. And this is a good idea, right? It is like we don't want to have the aristocracy and serfs, because that's a bad way for people to live. And so let's progress to democracy, which, you know, I mean, it's a bit technical to say this, but you had this feudalism, and then it kind of transformed into mercantilism, and then eventually ended up with democracy. And then you had socialism, and we took a bit of socialism and injected into our Western democracies. And so we have social welfare. And the problem is, over time, it became easier and easier for governments to win votes by just saying they'll give away more money to people. And that's not great for society either. And so I think it's certainly time to reassess how much of these tax dollars are being wasted in massive bureaucracies that are going to dish out money that was there to win votes, and how you can fix that without fundamentally leaving people worse off who are not capable of sustaining themselves in society because of various weaknesses they've got or challenges. And so I think, you know, it's hard enough to even say that as five sentences, let alone do it. And the big risk here, I think, is that so we have to have increased efficiency. I think the NDIS demonstrated what happens when you have good intentions but poor execution. And so we have to keep the good intentions and improve the execution. But it is very important, I think, to make sure that a whole lot of people don't end up living much worse lives as a consequence of the drive for efficiency. So I wish I could give you a one-line answer. It's a terrible political answer, but I think this is a dangerous, nuanced area, but one that has to be addressed.
Do you think it's better to go slowly and do it more over a longer period of time rather than immediately come in and just cut and be ruthless about government departments and the bloating generally of governmental bodies there?
I think the challenge is this. Let's use Elon as an example. He went into Twitter. He fired 50% of the staff. He could do that because it was his private business. He fired too many people. He had to bring some of them back. But fundamentally, he was right in assessing that was a bloated organization that wasn't being run efficiently. And so he could adjust for his mistakes. And the problem with taking the same attitude, you know, people say, well, you should run the government like you run a business. And the problem is that if you went and just, he didn't know which 50% of people to fire. So he kind of guessed. And you don't know, let's say you want to cut, I'll be extreme. You want to cut 50% of expenditure, let's say social expenditure. You don't know which 50% to cut, so you start cutting. And the problem is when you make mistakes, you end up with people, you know, dying of starvation or living in poverty or not having a house or not getting access to healthcare. And so you can't go and just be as aggressive when you're cutting social services as when you're doing stuff in a private business. And so
right.
the left will make that argument, and they're right with the argument, and the right will make the argument that will say, yeah, but there's so much waste, you've got to cut, you can't just keep endlessly taxing people and dishing out money and a whole lot of it gets wasted. And that argument is also valid. That's why I'm a centrist. Like, there is some balance between these two that you have to find, and I think generally I'm in favor of evolution rather than revolution as a concept, because revolution leaves a lot of dead bodies in its wake and doesn't turn out the way it started mostly. And I think society evolving is much better than saying let's have a revolution in expenditure, because I do think that, you know, revolutions are a dangerous game to play.
Will we in Australia ever have a Trump-like figure ourselves, or even someone like Singapore's long-serving and extremely consequential Prime Minister Lee Kuan Yew?
We don't want to go down the road of Singapore. It's a great country. It has had a great leader. It's not a democracy in the way that we view Western democracy. I think we want to hang on to what we've got. Australia's got a few things that are really fantastic in ensuring that polarization is never as bad in this country politically. It has compulsory voting, which is amazing. It means you force people that are, you know, think of a normal distribution curve of opinions. You force people in the middle of the curve to have to go and vote, who often don't vote in non-compulsory democracies because they don't feel strongly enough. They're not sitting on the fringes. So when you force them to vote, it moderates opinion in a country and is much more reflective of society's views. And then we have this preferential voting system, which effectively means that two people that run that have very similar views don't steal each other's votes and advantage somebody else. And what that means is that we may not end up with the person that got the most votes, but we end up with a person in each seat that is hated by the least number of people, would be the way that I would characterize it. And all of that tends towards the middle. Well, I think the problem is not that politicians are fundamentally worse today than they used to be. Like, that is looking at the past with rose-colored glasses. Sometimes you have really good politicians. Sometimes you don't have good ones. You have bad ones. Social media has made everybody probably look a bit worse than they are. But I think what's happened is over time we get more sophisticated. And so what you see is that advertising today is much more sophisticated than advertising 50 years ago in the Mad Men kind of era, which was probably 70 years ago. And so everything gets more sophisticated, and the understanding of how to manipulate the political landscape to be elected. That has gotten much more sophisticated over decades. And so now all of these polls and, you know, the nuance, it's too well understood, and it ends up driving decision-making of leaders rather than them saying, well, it's a bit of a black box, so what I'm going to do is have a guess, but fundamentally just do what I wanted to do as the reason I got power. I actually want to do something positive. And right. And I think that's the problem. That's what's happened over time.
Does anyone come to mind that has been a fabulous politician in any country at any point in time?
I tell you who I was disappointed about. So I was disappointed. I thought that Julia Gillard had potential to be a really great prime minister. Unfortunately, she came to power by the sword. And so it's live by the sword, die by the sword is probably fairly true. And so I think she was quite constrained, but I was kind of hopeful. She came from quite far to the left, moved much more to the middle over time, thought she had the potential to be really strong in Australia. I think...
in a sense, she's more respected now than she was then.
Yeah, I think, you know, also we have to be honest and say, look, I can say in the current times, I definitely skew more right of centre than left of centre, because the left has kind of abandoned the views that I think are the important things that the left has to offer. But I think, you know, Tony Abbott ran a very aggressive campaign against her. There was lots of misogyny against her, not specifically necessarily from him, but like she had a pretty terrible run. And I think she never got the clean air to be able to do some of the things that she would have liked to do and been able to do. She also appointed a terrible foreign minister in Bob Carr, which I think kind of sabotaged some of her initiatives along the way. So, you know, politics is a complex place. And I think there's a guy called, it's a bit of a digression, but there's a guy called Robert Caro who wrote a book called The Power Broker, which was about a guy called Robert Moses in New York, an unelected person who for 40 years was probably the most powerful person in New York. He also is writing his fifth installment of LBJ's biography. He has an understanding of power in his writing that very, very few people do. And I think that what's important is not to get power. What's important is to understand why you want power and how you're going to use it and how you're going to maximize your ability to use it for the brief period that you have it, and to do good things, or at least things that you think are good. And I think that is maybe what has gotten lost over time, as we've become fixated on the mechanics of power as opposed to the purpose of power.
I'd like to go back with the Albanese government promoting green tech and net zero emissions targets, as well as throwing strength at the teal movement, and also the existing power of the Green Party. How's it going to go up against Dutton's push for nuclear and Trump's winding back of green tech and focusing more on fossil fuels? And what's going to happen there? What's going to happen with this arm wrestle in Australia? And how's that going to affect businesses existing and upcoming?
Isn't it crazy that energy has become the political issue of the day? Like when electricity started rolling out in the late 1800s, and, you know, so in some places it wasn't rolled out until the 1930s or 40s, it wasn't political. Everyone was like, thank God for the miracle of electricity. And it was just life-changing, and everybody just realized the benefits that this could bring. And now we're in an era where we're having these big political wars about energy, when the real question is just we've got these ways of generating energy, which were the right ways to generate energy when we were just figuring this stuff out, electricity and, like, you know, internal combustion engines. But fundamentally, like, they make the world a much less pleasant place to live in. Long before there was the whole climate change concern, there was acid rain and other consequences of burning fossil fuels. Like, they're dirty and disgusting, and we should try and get rid of them no matter what the ideological motivation is underlying them. And then the question is, what should we get rid of them with? And that seems to be largely a scientific question that has turned into a political question. But it shouldn't be a political question. There are answers about nuclear energy, and there are answers about solar energy and wind energy and wave energy and whatever you might want to talk about. Like, there are scientific answers to these questions. Other things, the world will survive. I mean, God, it was survived a lot worse things than a few degrees of temperature. Just probably we won't survive if that heats up. And so instead of having a debate about, and by the way, even if that wasn't true, even if there was no such thing as climate change, I would still say, we've got to get away from these disgusting fuels that give us acid rain and pollute the earth. Nobody wants to live with those things. And also, they would run out eventually. Like, they're fossil fuels, and we're not going to have endless fossils. And so I think the problem is that climate change was turned into a religion. And then when there's a religious war going on one side of the political spectrum, there will be a response which is a religious war on the other side of the political spectrum. And I think that's how that evolved. And one of the things I find most counterintuitive politically in Western democracies is that you would think if one side of politics goes to the extreme, they leave the whole middle available for the other side of politics to take. That would be the logical thing to do. But it seems like for some reason, each side of politics needs to remain equidistant from the center. And so when one slides further to the extreme, the other slides further to the extreme, as if somehow they're connected. And that is the thing I've never really understood about Western democracy. So I think that's why energy is politicized. And as just a poor, innocent civilian trying to turn the lights on, like, I don't know what to make of all of this. I think it's extremely difficult. And until it depoliticizes, I think we're all at extreme risk of having very expensive, unreliable energy.
Adir, we're about to wrap up. I just want to know, is there any businessman that you respect or that you look up to in Australia?
I can talk maybe more about what do I think is worth admiring in business people.
So that was very diplomatic of you.
No, well, because I think, you know, my experience with the US and in particular with New York is that wealth in itself has become kind of virtue. It's synonymous with virtue. That's why the richest people in the US, they've taken on the roles that like the high priests used to have, you know, in like the medieval period, etc. And so because basically money has become virtue, and it's less so in Australia. I certainly do not think wealth is virtue. Actually, I think it's totally disconnected from virtue. And so I think that the best people in business are the people that you and I do not know about, because they are people that have made, I have to say, I know a few of them, but I'm not going to say their names, and you'll know why when I say this. They're people that have made lots of money and treated their workers really well, and then they've taken that money and used it to do really, really good things in society in relative anonymity without putting their names on things and making a big fuss. And they go about life in a normal kind of way. I mean, they have some trappings of wealth, like they travel a hell of a lot better than the average person. But they're not out there proclaiming that the fact that they're rich gives them some kind of virtue or some kind of deeper understanding into all other aspects of life. And so I think that's why they're not easy to speak about, because they're the people that do not trumpet their business success as being some kind of virtue.
What's the next industry to get disrupted?
Well, what's the industry that's not going to be disrupted? I mean, you know, I'm a bit more skeptical about large language models and generative AI, because I went through the cycle of what used to be called AI, which was convoluted neural networks and machine learning and computer vision. And I watch computer vision in industries that I'm close to not deliver on its promises for reasons of technical limitation. But I do think that it is extremely difficult to predict like what large language models are going to, with the impact they're going to have. I will say this. If you said to me, which industry do I think is already obviously being disrupted but people haven't noticed yet, I think that is any industry related to transport, especially road transport. I think we've passed a point where self-driving cars are here. We live in Australia, we don't feel it, but if you go to San Francisco or you go to LA or you go to Austin, you'll feel these self-driving cars will pick you up and they'll drive you to where you're going, and there'll be this great experience. And I think we've passed the threshold for self-driving cars, and they are going to mainstream very quickly. And I think every industry that is connected with people somehow driving cars, trucks, their own vehicles, etc., they are in for a 1 to 2 decade period of extreme disruption that is not less disruptive than what the internal combustion engine did to horses. I think that is the era that we're entering now.
Interesting. Adir, you obviously seem like a very, very well-spoken person. You're quite a polymath, I would have to say. What keeps you satiated and what inspires you in your day-to-day life?
I love people. So this conversation, I mean, like, you don't get to talk much in conversations where you're interviewing, unfortunately. Like, when this ends and then we can speak an equal amount, it will be much more interesting for me. And so I think that is the most interesting thing to me, is to speak to people that have different perspectives and different viewpoints, and to incorporate those viewpoints into my own perspective about the world, and just to hear about how different people's life experience has kind of shaped them, because each one of us is so limited in what we've experienced and what we know. And it's kind of suffocating to think about how little we've actually experienced the world. And so I have to say, like, the most interesting people for me, and the most interesting thing for me, is interacting with people who are also very curious about the world and kind of want to share their perspectives and hear my perspective.
Thank you so much, Adir, for coming on SBS Hebrew.
It's really lovely to chat.
רוצים לשמוע עוד סיפורים? האזינו דרך האפל פודקאסט, גוגל פודקאסט, ספוטיפיי, או בכל מקום אחר בו ניתן להאזין לפודקאסטים.